Hello and welcome to NewsHour from the BBC World Service. We're coming to you live from London. I'm James Menendez. Will the Trump administration continue to underwrite Ukraine's defence and security in the event of any peace agreement with Russia? Well, key to the future of the relationship between Kyiv and Washington seems to be a deal, just agreed in principle, allowing for the joint exploitation of Ukraine's extensive mineral resources. Initially, President Trump talked of extracting $500 billion from the deal as payment for past military assistance, which is, so far, by the way, more like a third of that figure. Well, that demand seems to have been dropped, although details remain scarce at this stage. We do know that so far the agreement doesn't include any guarantees about Ukraine's future security. And that's according to President Zelensky, who's been speaking in the past hour or so.
This visit before Putin is a very good signal, first of all. I think so. To my mind, I don't know how it will be. So I want to coordinate our position with American position. The war is in Ukraine, so for me, the Ukrainian position is a priority.
Well, as he suggested there, he may well be going to Washington this week, and there is a suggestion that the deal might, in some form, also be signed on Friday. Here's Mr. Trump speaking to reporters at the White House.
I hear that he's coming on Friday. Certainly, it's okay with me if he'd like to, and he would like to sign it together with me, and I understand that's a big deal, very big deal. And I think the American people, even if you look at polling, they're very happy because, you know, Biden was throwing money around like it's cotton candy, and it's a very big deal. Look, it could be a $1 trillion deal, it could be whatever, but it's rare earths and other things.
Well, in a moment, we'll hear from a member of the Ukrainian government. But first, Jeff Amrish-Ritto, who's a strategic advisor on energy and raw materials with the Hague Center of Strategic Studies. First of all, what exactly are the minerals Ukraine has under the ground?
Within the group of critical raw materials, there is a subgroup, a cluster, if you want to call it that way, of 17 resources, which together are called rare earth elements. Ukraine has several critical raw materials, of which the rare earth metals are one group, but they also have titanium, graphite, lithium, manganese, uranium, and beryllium in the ground.
And just give us an example for, titanium, just to take one. I mean, what's that used for?
Titanium is something that is used for very critical applications. So titanium metal is used for making planes. So Boeing and Airbus are very heavily dependent on titanium metal from Russia at the moment. And titanium dioxide, which Ukraine produces at the moment and is a very large producer of in the global production, is used for pigments and for making your steel pipes less corrosive.
And overall, what is the best guess about how much all of these minerals might be worth once they're extracted?
That's hard to say because, first of all, we know what Ukraine has in the ground when it comes to what it's currently producing. So for things like titanium, uranium, graphite, and manganese, it's easier to give an estimation of the value than for things that haven't been exploited yet and that have only been identified in the soil. So a lot of work still has to be done to really identify the size of those reserves and also to conduct more feasibility studies to see whether these reserves are economically exploitable.
What's your best guess? I mean, are we talking hundreds of billions of dollars, $1 trillion?
Well, if we look at the data that the Ukrainian Geological Survey has published, and those are very high-level numbers, and also based on, let's say, old data, even dating back from the Soviet era, depending on the scope, you could say that Ukrainian resources are worth somewhere between $1 trillion and $14 trillion US dollars.
Right. So very big money indeed. And where are they found in Ukraine? Are they found across the country or are some found in particular areas? I'm thinking, of course, are some found in the east of the country currently occupied by Russia?
Yeah. There are certain resources and critical raw materials found in the east in occupied territory. But if you would draw a map on the table, then you would see that there are different pockets of critical raw materials scattered around the country. The Ukrainian Geological Survey also indicated that they, for obvious reasons, don't want to pinpoint all of those locations because it could potentially also make a target of the country, of course.
I noticed, for example, that lithium, for example, is found in the far east of the country, isn't it?
Yeah, that's indeed the case. And the big question that I personally have when looking at the deal that has been struck between the two countries is, does this deal include the critical raw materials that are located in occupied territory? The deal is silent about that, but that will obviously be something that will have to be negotiated with the Russians.
And do you have any understanding of the mechanism of the deal? Who will own these materials? Who will exploit them? Will it be American companies? How will it work, do you think?
Yeah, look, there are a couple of big question marks about this deal, right? So we know that Ukraine will set up a fund and that it will contribute 50% of all future revenues generated from the sales of critical raw materials in the future to this fund. But what is not clear is what the contribution of the Americans will be. Will they also contribute financially to the fund? Will they send American companies to help develop these assets? And do they want a preferential treatment when it comes to offtake rights for these minerals and materials? So all of that is not really clear at the moment. And from what we understand, these subjects will have to be negotiated in consequent agreements.
And that was minerals and energy expert Jeff Umrich-Ritto, who's a strategic advisor on the subject at the Hague Center of Strategic Studies. Well, Yuri Sack is an advisor to Ukraine's Ministry of Strategic Industries. Is this a good deal then for Ukraine as it stands?
Good afternoon. This is a framework deal which is much better than the original draft that we saw a little over a week now.
Why is it better? Why is it better?
Well, because our president said it very clearly that we see that deal. And actually, I'd need to stress that using our critical minerals and rare earth minerals as part of this process was actually our idea. It was included in the victory plan that was presented by our president some time ago. And but we look at this deal through the prism of it having to be fair. And, you know, our president will not be able to sign anything which is detrimental to the national interests of Ukraine. So the original draft included some figures, some formulations and lack of security guarantees, which was unacceptable to Ukrainian side. And we made it very clear. Working groups on both sides have worked since to improve the draft, and this framework agreement now has been published by the government, and hopefully it will be signed on Friday when the two presidents meet.
But what about those security guarantees? They're still missing, right?
Well, this, I will repeat, this is a framework agreement, and its purpose is to set up a fund that in the future will deal with the distribution of proceeds that will result from the exploration and processing of these critical minerals. And in point number 10 of this agreement, there is also a mention of the necessity to view this agreement only as part of a wider and broader architecture of security guarantees. And that's how we see it. And that will be further, of course, discussed by the parties. And hopefully it will be signed.
If it is signed on Friday, and even if it is just a preliminary agreement, I mean, it sounds like Ukraine is giving up quite a lot before it's got the security guarantees it needs.
Well, we understand that this negotiating when you approach this negotiating process very pragmatically, we know that not everything can be agreed in one day, and you know this is the first stage. And, you know, going forward, this agreement will have to be supplemented by further, more detailed, more comprehensive other agreements, including in the field of security guarantees, as well as in the economic sphere. So this is, let's put it that way, this is a good start, and we hope that this will move the negotiating process forward.
From a financial point of view, I mean, is it a 50-50 partnership with the US? Is that the idea?
In a way, I mean, if you look at the text, the way the agreement is spelled out at the moment, it is a 50-50 going forward for the future proceeds. So it's not like we'll be paying off our debt, and that's also a very important point for us.
Right. So it's about future costs. And I mean, what's the thinking within the government? Is it that, you know, if the US or perhaps US companies have a big financial stake in Ukraine's future, that in itself will provide some sort of security guarantee?
We have seen it many times, you know, in other countries around the world, that the mere presence of the American investments in other territories is never a guarantee that, you know, the wars will not break out or the dictatorships will not invade. So we are, you know, very well aware of the of what kind of country Russia is. It's, for us, it's a country which is an aggressor, a terrorist state. So we don't see that it will be feasible to sign this agreement, or this or any other agreement for that matter, without robust and very comprehensive security guarantees. You know, we need to be able to close our skies. We need to be able to secure the Black Sea region. We need probably a contingent of foreign troops on our land to ensure that Russia doesn't reinvade, because otherwise it would be pointless.
Sure, but presumably, I mean, Russia is thinking, well, look, I definitely want to hold on to the territory that they're occupying at the moment, that they've already taken, because as we were hearing, there may well be, you know, big deposits there.
According to our estimates, about 20% of our deposits are currently located in the temporarily occupied territory. And we've said it that, you know, at this stage, I mean, we will not compromise on our territorial integrity. That has to be, you know, we've said this to the US, we've said it to everybody. And we understand that in this negotiating process, at this point in time, we will not be able to get back all of our territory. But at some point in the future, we will reclaim it, maybe through diplomatic means. So that's how we see it. You know, our territory, aggressor must not be appeased, because we must not forget that, you know, now while the discussion right now is focusing around these critical minerals, this war is still about values. It is still a war about, you know, between a tyranny and a freedom, free independent country.
Okay. That was Yuri Sack, who's an advisor to Ukraine's Ministry of Strategic Industries. There is more on this on our website. There's a live page up and running with some more of President Zelensky's comments. He's been speaking today in the past hour or two. And a comment from the Ukrainian Prime Minister, who talks about the minerals deal envisaging an investment fund for Ukraine's reconstruction, and that it would be managed on equal terms between Kyiv and Washington. There is also a useful map of Ukraine, just showing where some of those main deposits, including deposits of titanium and graphite, where they're located in the country. bbc.com/news. You're listening to NewsHour. Still to come on the programme, do horror movies deserve more mainstream film awards?
I constantly have conversations with people who say they don't like horror films, and then they will say things like that their favourite film's The Shining. I remember speaking to somebody who said to me that they didn't like horror, but they loved Fire Walk With Me, the David Lynch film. And I said, well, that's a horror film. And they said, well, no, it's a David Lynch film. So another example of transcending the genre. Horror is such a huge genre.
More on that coming up in half an hour. Our main headlines from the newsroom once again. President Volodymyr Zelensky says Ukraine has not yet received the security guarantees it needs from the United States. And the Bibas family has said that Israeli officials should bear responsibility for the deaths of hostages in Gaza. They've told mourners at the funeral of Shiri and her two young children their lives could have been saved. This is James Menendez with NewsHour live from the BBC. Well, let's turn to the Middle East now, because it seems as if the ceasefire deal between Israel and Hamas is now back on track. There have been fears it might break down altogether. On Saturday, Israel refused to release 600 Palestinian prisoners due to be handed over in return for six Israeli hostages freed in Gaza. It accused Hamas of parading the hostages for propaganda purposes. Let's talk to our Middle East regional editor, Sebastian Usher, who joins us live from Jerusalem. And developments in the past few minutes, Sebastian. Hamas talking about their next steps in this prisoner-hostage exchange.
Yes. I mean, what we knew an hour ago was that the last part of phase one of the ceasefire deal, which would be the release of four dead hostages by Hamas and then the delayed release of more than 600 Palestinian prisoners, would also take place. We've now got a timing for that. I mean, I think one still has to be a little bit careful to say this will 100% happen, but it's coming from the horse's mouth, so to say. The spokesman for Hamas's armed wing has just named four hostages before dead hostages and said that they will be released this evening at 11 p.m. local time. We've also heard from the prisoners' authority, who deal with the reception of Palestinian prisoners, that they're expecting them to be released at the same time. And this idea that there would be simultaneous action from both sides was the one that I think helped to resolve this issue, so that phase one, at least, of the ceasefire deal could go ahead as scheduled.
And how did the negotiators manage to unblock some of the obstacles that were facing the ceasefire deal? I mean, was it that they managed to extract some assurances that Hamas wouldn't repeat the sort of hostage releases that we've seen in the past?
Yes, I think that's exactly it. I mean, that, I think, the final straw for Israel, for the people as well as the government, was last Thursday, when four dead bodies, the bodies of the family that the funeral has taken place today, of the Bibas family, the two children and the mother, that they were handed over. And it was done in a ceremony, again, very, very public, very much a propaganda event by Hamas. There'd been, at each hostage handover before that, of living hostages, the same thing. But the fact that it was hostages who were dead, and this family in particular, who come to symbolise the horror of October the 7th for Israelis, that it really pushed not just the government, as I say, but I think the Israeli public to the edge, and it led to the suspension of the release of 600 Palestinian prisoners that was due to take place on Saturday, in return for six more living hostages who were released that day. And it's an assurance, that's what we've heard from Egyptian mediators, from Hamas, that they will do this privately, the handing over of these next dead bodies of hostages, that has meant that this is now going ahead. So, as I say, the first phase looks like it will come to a successful end, but we really don't know where the ceasefire heads next.
Yeah, I mean, it presumably remains pretty fragile, because actually, you know, the really hard stuff is yet to be discussed, or even talked about being discussed, isn't it?
Absolutely. And this was hard enough. I think the mediators have had their work cut out just to keep this part of the process going. There have been, you know, a number of stumbling blocks. This was the latest one, perhaps the biggest one. But the talks on what's supposed to be phase two, which would see the release of all the remaining hostages, alive or dead, in Gaza, but also the withdrawal of all Israeli troops from Gaza and a permanent end to hostilities there. Those talks, as far as we know, haven't begun in earnest at all. And they essentially, phase one is due to end on Saturday. So the lines, I think, are being blurred by the Trump administration, by the Israelis, over this distinction between two phases, and maybe turning it into an extension of this first phase, with talks hopefully getting underway and looking at how to deal with those issues. I mean, I think, you know, the two most intractable issues essentially are the role of Hamas in Gaza if hostilities come to an end. The Israeli government essentially saying Hamas must disarm, it must play no part politically. Hamas has not accepted that. And the other side, that Israel is, from the Palestinian perspective, a Hamas perspective, not meant to be able to continue to carry out attacks inside Gaza when and if it feels that it's necessary for its security, which the Israeli government under the Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has essentially been demanding throughout. So how they bridge that gap is going to be very difficult.
Sebastian, thank you very much indeed. Sebastian Usher joining us live there from Jerusalem. Now, when sport meets politics, because Afghanistan's men's team is playing England in the Champions Trophy tournament today. The match is taking place in Lahore in Pakistan. But beforehand, there have been calls and a petition signed by nearly 200 UK parliamentarians for England to boycott the match in protest at the Taliban's refusal to allow women to play sport. Most of the Afghan women's team now live and play in exile in Australia. I've been talking to Devendra Kumar, often called the voice of Afghan cricket, and also a commentator for the BBC. How is the women's team feeling about the match going ahead?
I can understand the sentiment from the women's team, but they would always support men's playing the game of cricket, because cricket has always been the biggest source of hope and happiness for Afghans, for everyone, for men and women. But I can understand the frustration from the women, because enough has not been done by the ICC and cricket board to promote the women's cricket.
And what about the men's team? I mean, did they ever consider, you know, not playing this match in support of their female colleagues?
They've been advocating women's cricket and women's education for the last 3 years. Then some of the players like Mohammad Nabi and Rashid Khan, they went to visit the politicians and they have spoken to them. But they cannot do much because they are cricketers. They can only play cricket and can send messages through various social networking sites just to keep the country together in this difficult time, because the country has been embroiled in war for 40 years. And they know that whatever they can do, they have done more than any other cricketer on the planet can do for their country mates and for the women's as well.
Explain something for us, Devendra, because as I understand it, cricket's international governing body, the ICC, I mean, its rules say that members have to have both a men's and a women's team if they're going to be part of the ICC. So, I mean, why are they not enforcing that in this case?
They understand the fragility in the country. The country has been into the war for many years, and they know that through cricket, they can unite the people. And that is the only way they can engage the outside forces to make difference to the lives of the Afghan people. Because of the poverty, because of terrorism for many years, because of the war, most of the people have lost at least one family member from each family in Afghanistan. So they understand the pain. They understand the trauma that caused to the psyche of the Afghan people. And that's why it's important to give something back to the Afghanistan. And cricket is the only way to engage with them. And whenever there is a cricket match, the whole country comes together. People from different ethnicity live in Afghanistan, from different regions, they come together. There's a sense of community in Afghanistan. For example, when there is a game going on, like today, England is playing against Afghanistan. There are at least 50 different locations where people have gathered to watch cricket on big screen. And that allows the communication, that allows the talk with the political people as well to bring about some changes in the society. It's not going to happen so quickly. It's going to take some time, but they know that cricket is the only medium through which they can bring about some difference to the lives of the Afghan people.
Yeah. Devendra, we've just got sort of 30 seconds left. What's going on in the match? Bring us up to date.
325, that's what Afghanistan scored. Ibrahim scored a wonderful century, a majestic century, you know, dealing the fearsome bowling attack of England. Jofra Archer, Mark Wood, they did exceedingly well. 2 wickets down at the moment for 71. Root is still there, so Root holds the key for England to win this game. It's a must-win situation. If Afghanistan goes on to win, they will be playing Australia, and hopefully they will play the semi-final as well, okay, as they played in the ICC T20 World Cup.
Commentator Devendra Kumar there. You're listening to NewsHour. Do stay with us. Lots more coming up in the second half. Welcome back to NewsHour. There was a time when BP, British Petroleum, tried to rebrand itself as Beyond Petroleum and as a leader in alternative, cleaner energy sources. Well, that strategy seems to be out of the window. Today it announced it would cut investment in renewables and pump $10 billion a year into boosting oil and gas production. So why? A question for our business editor, Simon Jack.
Well, they say that the transition to green energy has not gone as fast or as smoothly as they thought. So initial promises made 5 years ago to cut oil and gas production 40% by 2030, which they were downgraded in 2023 to 25% cut. And today they were binned completely. And in fact, they're going to increase, as you said in your introduction, oil and gas production by pumping more money into that, while at the same time slashing investments into renewables, which obviously has got cries of delight from some shareholders and cries of dismay from other environmental groups.
Was that the problem, that investors in the company said, look, this is all very well, this pivot to green energy, but it's just not making us any money?
It turns out there's less money in renewables than there is in oil and gas. And if you look, and the real reason behind this is that some shareholders are very impatient, very angry, that over the last 5 years, since those targets were imposed, they've got a return of 35% on their money. Compare that to Shell, sister company, has made 80%, and Exxon, the US-based company, 160%. And you can understand why some of the shareholders say, listen, we've had enough of doing this. Your job is not to make climate policy. Your job is to make money for us shareholders. You're not doing it fast enough and far enough, and we need some change. And that was what they were trying to address today.
And presumably, I mean, as you hinted, I mean, environmentalists, well, and indeed, presumably, governments around the world that are trying to, you know, cut output of carbon are saying, well, look, this is going in the wrong direction.
Well, it's very interesting because different countries view this in very different ways. In the UK, there is a moratorium on new oil and gas exploration licences, but 90% of BP's activities are outside of where it's headquartered in the UK. 90% is elsewhere, including in places like the Gulf of Mexico, which in their earnings, by the way, they refer to as the Gulf of America, which tells you quite a lot about how much influence the Trump White House is having. His famous mantra, drill, baby, drill, has been heard around the world. And a lot of companies have already started to gravitate that, seeing as it giving them more political cover to do that. And you've seen Shell and others begin to do that. And BP, if you like, is the last of the oil majors to sort of fall into line with that. Some of the renewable companies, of course, have expressed some disappointment, as have climate groups. They say BP may say that it's not going far enough and fast enough. We say it didn't go far enough and didn't give transition a chance. At the height, it only invested less than 10% in renewables. That was not enough to give it a fair shake. But we're in a new world order, as it were. And as if to illustrate the point, BP just yesterday signed a deal in Iraq of $25 billion to cultivate and develop some of their oil fields there.
And that was Simon Jack, the BBC's business editor, on that pivot by BP towards more oil and gas production. You're listening to NewsHour. This is NewsHour live from the BBC in London. I'm James Menendez. Let's return to the question of Western support for Ukraine now, because in just a few short weeks, that has upended the decades-long transatlantic relationship between the US and its NATO partners in Europe. It's changed the debate within those European countries about what they need to spend on defence, as well as arguably changing the dynamic of the war. The Trump administration's already started talking to Russia about a possible settlement in Ukraine. More talks are scheduled in Istanbul tomorrow, and all without the direct participation of either Kyiv or Europe. Furthermore, President Trump has accused Ukraine of starting the war when it was Russia that launched a full-scale invasion almost exactly 3 years ago, and described as a dictator, not Vladimir Putin, but Volodymyr Zelensky, Ukraine's president. Well, suddenly the tectonic plates of global power are shifting, and shifting in unpredictable ways. So what's the thinking in the White House? Well, one organisation that should know is the Heritage Foundation, a conservative think tank in DC, which drew up what is essentially a manifesto for the second Trump term called Project 2025. Many of its contributors are very close indeed to the administration. I've been talking to the Foundation's president, Kevin Roberts. I began by asking him about the mineral deal with Ukraine and the absence of security guarantees. Why does he think the administration seems to be so reluctant to underwrite Ukraine's future sovereignty?
The answer to your question is because we need European countries to pull their own weight. The United Kingdom always has, but in particular, the countries of Germany and France have this habit, which is very dismaying to common sense Americans who want to continue our alliance with Europe. And that is, they come to the United States and they wag their finger and they tell Americans that we need to send more and more money to defend a place like Ukraine, which of course we want to participate in defending, when they themselves don't pull their own weight. And so it's not really a question of whether the United States is willing to be a good ally. It's a question of why our other allies have this double standard. And so until and unless they step up and pull their weight, I think Donald Trump is very right to stick to his guns on this.
And yet overall, European countries and EU institutions have so far pledged and spent more than the US on helping Ukraine, haven't they?
If you look at what the United States has sent to Ukraine, it's about $250 billion. I look at this from the standpoint of the American taxpayer, who, of course, deserves some understanding of what the strategic endgame is here. I will remind you that for 3 years, many of us in the United States have been saying, why are we doing this if we don't understand what the strategic end game is? Obviously, Mr. Trump's predecessor, President Biden, deserves most of the blame for that. But in the case of Germany and France, until and unless they start spending the same percentage of their GDP that we do in the United States, they simply do not have the right to tell us we haven't done enough.
Was President Trump right to call President Zelensky a dictator and to accuse Ukraine of starting the war?
President Trump is right to raise questions about a persistent problem in Ukraine, which certainly predates Mr. Zelensky, and it is the corruption that has gone on there. At Heritage, we publish every year the Index of Economic Freedom, and Ukraine consistently ranks in the bottom 10 of all countries in the world for corruption. Mr. Zelensky is someone who has not succeeded in cleaning that up. He has suspended elections. He actually has violated religious liberty. I think it's really important to raise those questions for him, because while he has been presented as this lily-white hero in Western media, in fact, he has some things to answer. He's going to get the opportunity to do that, particularly if he agrees to this minerals deal.
Winston Churchill suspended elections in Britain during the Second World War, didn't he?
I think it's disgusting to equate Winston Churchill to Vladimir Zelensky.
Why?
Because Winston Churchill was a hero who saved the West. Zelensky decided that it was more important to be on the cover of Vogue magazine than it was to actually stay in his country. And I would just submit to you something that I hear as I travel the United States. At the very least, when he meets with the American president, he ought to put a damn suit on.
You quote Ronald Reagan in your foreword to the Project 2025 manifesto a couple of times. I mean, one of the quotes is, freedom must be fought for and defended constantly. I mean, isn't that what Ukrainians have been doing for the past 3 years?
Oh, they have. And let me be clear, we support that. I think it's obviously just and it's important that they do so. That's not the question. The question is, why is this? Does this double standard persist, particularly with the Germans and French, and their governments telling us that the United States has not done enough when they themselves are not spending the requisite percentage of their GDP on their defense?
So support for Ukraine will and should continue in the years to come.
Support for Ukraine might continue from the United States if Mr. Zelensky and our supposed allies across Europe pull their own weight and be realistic about something that the Western media, including your outlet, and I say that respectfully as a friend, have told us, and that is that the war is winnable for the Ukrainians. I lament the tragedy that it is not. Mr. Zelensky is going to have to deal with the reality that he can't get all of that territory back. I hate that reality.
Yeah, I was going to say, isn't it right that he at least tries to defend that territorial integrity?
It's very important for us to understand that only until Donald Trump was elected president did all of these Western leaders realize what the reality on the ground was. President Trump deserves a lot of credit for that.
So why is the U.S. apparently siding with Russia over Ukraine, the U.N., for example, and indeed aligning itself not just with Russia, but countries like Belarus and North Korea? Are those countries America's friends?
I reject the premise of that question, too. The United States is siding with reality.
Right. But, I mean, you can see how it looks. You have the U.S., Russia, Belarus and North Korea all voting against a motion in support of Ukraine.
The United States is trying to lead the way in the absence of leadership across Europe in bringing this war to a close to save innocent lives.
Sure. And I understand. I'm just trying to understand, though, also whose side America at the moment is on. Is it on Ukraine's side or Russia's side or neither?
The United States is on the side of the everyday American who is ready to see the Trump-Vance administration continue to do what they're doing, which is focus on our domestic politics, our domestic problems, to stop throwing away money at an unwinnable war.
And where do American families' interests lie? Do they lie more with Russia than with defending Ukraine?
The interests of Americans lie in their own local communities, which has been ravaged by globalization and all kinds of neoconservative adventurism that we're trying to put an end to.
Can I ask you this? I know you're not a fan of China, not a fan of the Chinese Communist Party by any means. I just wonder, how do you think President Xi will be viewing the negotiations so far over Ukraine? And, as you say, the apparent acceptance by the administration that Ukraine can't win and cannot retake all the territory that it's lost. Do you think President Xi will be thinking, well, I can invade Taiwan at some point in the next 4 years and America won't do anything about it?
No, I think quite the opposite. It's a good question, a fair question. But I think the opposite, because what President Xi has seen over the last 3 years is that the United States has been willing to spend $250 billion on an unwinnable war, however justified it is, without a strategic endgame, without any accountability or enough accountability on the expenditures. And I think what he's seeing in the leadership of President Trump in bringing the Ukraine war to a close is the kind of strength of the American president. In fact, I think that Mr. Xi looks at what President Trump is doing in Europe, particularly in cajoling reluctant allies, particularly the German and French governments, to spend more on defense, and sees that this is probably the moment that he has really been lamenting, and that is that strength and moral clarity from the American president actually are persuading European allies, who can be great allies if they're doing the requisite defense spending. I think the Chinese Communist Party is probably very concerned by this.
Can I just ask you one more question about that? You talk about moral clarity, about President Trump's comments accusing Ukraine of starting the war. I mean, is that the moral clarity, that he believes Ukraine is responsible for this conflict and not Russia?
I think the point that Mr. Trump was getting at is that the saber rattling over Ukraine joining NATO over the past 10 or 15 years was really bad geopolitics. And I think it's really important that that be taken off the table, going back to your first question about the absence of American security requirements on behalf of Ukraine. That's really the point that I think the president is trying to make.
Right, but in terms of the morality of the conflict, if we can talk about that, America's moral interests lie with Ukraine and not Russia.
Look, Russia's the aggressor. Putin's evil. He's terrible. That's really clear. Two things can be true at once.
Can I just ask you a couple of questions about domestic politics? I mean, Project 2025 was about returning power to the people, the electors. Donald Trump has been issuing executive order after executive order. Many around the world seem to think he's behaving more like a monarch, an autocrat. Is he?
Well, anyone thinking that around the world just needs to study American civics more closely, and they'll realize two things. Number one, the president of the United States does have the right to issue executive orders. And I wonder if you might have asked that question 7, 8, 9 years ago of someone allied with President Obama, who set the record for executive orders. But the second thing is, and it's a broader point that's really important for friends to understand, these executive orders are aimed at what has been a largely unconstitutional enlargement of the federal government. And so not only are they constitutional and proper, they're glorious when it comes to restoring power to the American people.
And what if they come up against judicial power? Elon Musk has talked about a tyranny of the judiciary. What should happen to judges who try to block the executive's wishes?
First of all, this is how our system works. We, as you know well, we've got three branches of government. One of the problems, the second point into the heart of your question, is that a handful of American judges go beyond the scope of their legal and constitutional authority and try to do the work of both the legislative and executive branches. And if they do that, they ought to be impeached, which is spelled out very clearly in our Constitution.
So should the executive branch be supreme amongst those three branches? Is that how you see things going forward over the next 4 years, that it takes on more power, more responsibility?
Our Constitution's really clear. We've got three branches of government. Our founders, both in their constitutional debates as well as in the very eloquent Federalist Papers, talk about them being co-equal. And that's what the current administration is doing in resetting the table. The problem is not in what President Trump has been doing. The problem has been in what very politically liberal administrations, especially starting with President Obama and continuing through the Biden administration, have done.
So you'd be the first to call out President Trump if you thought, as well, one recent poll suggested 57% of respondents thought he was acting beyond his presidential authority. If you saw that, you would call it out, would you?
Of course we would. At Heritage, we're objective. We are politically conservative, but we're not partisan. We're not part of the two-party system. I will be really clear, though, up to this point, President Trump is not only exercising his full constitutional authority, this is a much outdated and much needed reset of the co-equal branches of government.
And that was Kevin Roberts, who's president of the Heritage Foundation in Washington, D.C. You're listening to NewsHour. This is James Menendez with NewsHour. Syria's new leadership has repeatedly promised to include all groups when it comes to running the country and shaping the country's future. It held a conference of national dialogue this week in Damascus. But one big group was conspicuous by its absence, Syria's Kurds. They control an enclave in the northeast, but there are ongoing clashes with militias backed by Turkey, which has long regarded the Kurds as a threat. Complicating matters is the fact that the Kurdish-led Syrian Democratic Forces are allies of the US, helping them to defeat so-called Islamic State. The BBC's GR Gold has been to Syria's Kurdish-held areas to find out what they want for their future.
As we cross the ancient Tigris River over a floating bridge from Iraqi Kurdistan, the minibus carrying us and several other civilians shakes and rattles. We are heading to the Kurdish-controlled northeastern region of Syria. Syrian Kurds call it Rojava, meaning the west of Kurdistan. 10 years ago, the so-called Islamic State militants, ISIS, swept through the northeast, reaching the iconic city of Kobani on the border with Turkey. ISIS imposed a tight siege over the city that lasted months. I join hundreds of Kobani's residents as they celebrate the 10th anniversary of their liberation from the terror of ISIS.
You see so many young girls and women holding each other's hands, dancing and chanting in joy. I can imagine they have so many reasons to dance, because if ISIS was ruling this region, I am sure they wouldn't be able to leave their home as a woman.
Not far from Kobani, fighting rages on between the Kurdish-led SDF and Turkey-backed Syrian forces. Turkey sees one large armed component that is part of the SDF alliance as a terrorist organization. It wants to expel the group from its borders. For weeks, Turkish drones have been targeting SDF supply routes. And even civilian anti-war protests have come under attack.
We're dancing, and I was the last one in the row.
This is Leo Bonsi, a 28-year-old German peace activist who has been volunteering at a woman's shelter here for 2 years. She was injured in a recent attack.
I actually bumped in the middle of the people.
On her hospital bed, she shows us a video of two projectiles flying down from the air and hitting the ground in the middle of a group of people dancing. The protest was held near a strategic dam where fighting has been ongoing.
An old man also got injured. I lost some blood. That's why they wanted to send me to the hospital. But when we went into the ambulance car, again a drone attack next to our ambulance.
Human Rights Watch condemned the drone attacks on ambulances and the killing of civilians as apparent war crimes committed by the Turkish SNA coalition. But the Turkish government denies targeting civilians and infrastructure, instead accusing Kurdish forces of using civilians as human shields. Back in Kobani, locals fear that the battle could reach the city at any point. Syria's new president, Ahmed al-Shaar, has called on all armed groups in Syria to lay down their weapons. But for the Kurdish forces, who face an existential threat to their presence in the northeast, this may not be an option. Damascus and the Kurdish-led SDF forces have been negotiating a solution for the northeast. But Commander Mazlum Abdi tells me the situation remains tense.
In reality, we are still at war with Turkey and its proxies. Turkish jets and drones continue to bomb us. In Damascus, it remains unclear what steps the new government will take. Their statements are positive, but they are under pressure from Turkey to act against the areas under our control.
In one of Kobani's cemeteries, I join mourners as they bury two Kurdish fighters killed in a recent attack. Stability in Syria may be on the horizon, but for the Kurds, the future is uncertain.
That was G.R. Gol, who's BBC Persian's world affairs correspondent, reporting there from Syria.
There's been a slight misuse of the substance.
That's a trailer for The Substance, starring Demi Moore. It's one of the favourites for Best Picture at the Oscars on Sunday night. If it does win, it'll be the first time a horror film's bagged the top award since The Silence of the Lambs more than 30 years ago. In The Substance, a fading celebrity takes a black market drug, a cell-replicating chemical that temporarily creates a younger, better version of herself. But things go horribly wrong. So, why are horror films and the actors that star in them often overlooked at the big award ceremonies? Anna Smith is film critic and host of the Girls on Film podcast. Mark Jenkins, a British movie maker who directed the 2023 horror film Enes Mem.
I think the reason it has cut through is it is actually a rare case of a horror film that transcends the genre. It's quite difficult to transcend the horror genre, I think. I made a film that may or may not be a horror film. But the horror genre tends to overshadow what the films are actually about. I think The Substance is a rare case where it kind of cuts through, and I think that's why it's getting the recognition. I think a lot of horror films they're kind of considered a bit separate to other movies, and a lot of films, people can watch horror films and love them, but they'll always remain as horror films rather than kind of cutting through and transcending the genre. And that's what's exciting about The Substance and the recognition it's getting is that it has kind of cut through.
I think it's a fascinating genre. I think there's so much opportunity to explore the human psyche, to play with really interesting ideas, to push boundaries. I mean, of course, there are many, many different types of horror, and there's certain types of horror I don't think you'll ever see nominated for Academy Awards. But this kind, The Substance, you know, which really does have a very strong social message, I think can push through. So I think it is a great genre in potentially. I mean, one thing to think about with Academy Awards, I do think there is some prejudice against horror movies, as Mark was saying. I think there is perhaps a sense that it's a genre that is quite populist, or some people, I mean, when you think about your friends, there's always some people that just don't go near horror because they're too scared, or they just don't like the sound of it. And I think the same may apply within the Academy membership. You know, it's not for everyone. The Substance is a great film. I'm so pleased that it's been nominated, but it is quite divisive. You know, everyone has a slightly different take on it.
I constantly have conversations with people who say they don't like horror films, and then they will say things like that their favourite film's The Shining. I remember speaking to somebody who said to me that they didn't like horror, but they loved Fire Walk With Me, the David Lynch film. And I said, well, that's a horror film. And they said, well, no, it's a David Lynch film. So another example of transcending the genre. Horror is such a huge genre.
Mark Jenkin, filmmaker and film critic Anna Smith there. And that brings us to the end of this edition of NewsHour. From me and the rest of the team here in London, thanks so much for listening. I'll be back at the same time tomorrow. Until then, bye-bye.